sense of thoughtfulness.
What's the book going to be called, by the way?
Well, I'm not sure. I didn't start off writing a book about social credit. I started off with from a slightly different angle. The people who control the money supply and that. If I can just go through this a bit. Before money, there was, of course, barter, wasn't there?
Yes.
Money came into existence basically for convenience, because, I mean...
Yes, and there were tallies and all sorts of different kinds of money before the idea of having... But, again, this... you can get this far better from a an encyclopedia than I can tell you about it. When money became associated with gold, that's when things went wrong. Because if you want to have a medium which will exchange goods other than by barter, it must not have value in itself. Nothing that has value in itself, a commodity, can be useful, for the simple reason that one, as soon as that has value in itself, people can use it. When it should be only used as a coin, they can melt it down and buy with it. Now that's its function is gone then. So the idea that money is associated with gold at all is bound to go wrong, and it has done all the time. So that's and we've had gold since 1694. Before that, 1694 is the date when things went badly wrong in this country. You know all about that, don't you? Well, there's no need to tell you about that then, but I can tell you what happened during that when that occurred in 1694. These chappies, merchant bankers they were, realised that they could get away with something here, so the king wanting money, William III.
That was to fight a war, was it?
It was for mercenaries, I think. He wanted to buy mercenaries. Anyway, they had 1,200,000. They would lend it to him at 8% plus 4,000 a year for management fee, plus the condition that they were able to form a bank to be called the Bank of England, but it was nothing of the sort. It was a privately operating bank. And that a lien should be put on goods coming into the country so that the interest could be paid for certain. And that made quite sure that he didn't welsh on the...
The front man for the bankers was a pirate, I believe, William Paterson.
William Paterson. He was not a pirate.
A bit of a shady character.
I don't know whether he was he was just given what do they call it? Wait a minute, you better drop it off a bit until I...
That's all right.
A merchant, not adventurer, but a merchant banker, if you like. He was there were merchants who traded with other countries. I think he was one of those. I suspect they might be called pirates. Well, I've never heard of him being called a pirate before. Anyway, that's how the things were.
Yeah, that's how Britain got saddled with the national debt.
Because they demanded, this was the thing that started it, they demanded that they should be able to issue their own notes to the value of the loan they had made. Now, that is the important thing. They then began, they were creating money. And that was the first time they did create money.
That was the first time in England, but it had been going on for a long time since the goldsmiths and that.
Yes, well, maybe it had, but I don't know what happened there. But in this country, and then other bankers, there were other bankers, and they saw this happening, and they began to create their own notes. Well, I've got somewhere in one of my the things that I've written, that there came a time when in a certain period, I forget what the date is now, but I can give it to you. There's a date by which hundreds of banks were issuing their own notes, and it was real chaos. And it was then that the 1844, I think it was, the Bank Charter Act forbade them to issue their own notes, and it was left with the London banks to do it, and then finally the Bank of England alone. But remember, it was not an English bank, it was a privately operating bank all the time until 1964, when it was nationalised.
46, you mean?
46. In 1946 it was nationalised, but they haven't, they've not gone in for creating money.
Who were the original owners of the Bank of England, apart from William Paterson and Company?
Oh, nobody.
It was
a privately operating bank.
Do we know the names of the people?
Well, I think the names of the people would just be those who, from whom we collected part of it in order to get somewhere near the figure that the king wanted. That's all. I don't think there's anything else in it but that. But then there were banks creating money all the time after that. It was a shocking business.
Yeah, that's called basically the fractional reserve gimmick, isn't it?
Well, the fractional reserve gimmick,
printing more money than you've got,
is the association of this with gold, isn't it, at the time. The amount of gold they had it was the goldsmiths who started the fractional reserve idea, because it was they who saw that only a tenth of the gold was ever wanted out at any one time. Now that's continued today, because the bankers can issue 10 times. Let me take you now to a money program which said, showed you how £1 issued as a loan can finally become 7. They could issue £7 for every £1 that they had as a deposit. Now, that's what the figure they gave. I was listening to a talk in Filey by a bank manager of the Trustee Savings Bank, and he knew his onions about banking. And he finally said this, that they do issue more than they have in deposits. It's about 3 times. So when questions came, I said, "You said that they issue 3 times as much as they receive in deposits." He said, "Yes." I said, "It's 7. Oh, he said, "I didn't know that." I said, "You'll find that given in the money programme on the BBC." So although it was 10, and some people stick to that figure, there is at least 7 times. Now, 6 of those is not real money, if you're counting gold as the basis. But now it's deposits as the basis. Now, let me give you an idea as to how this comes about, how the creation of money comes about. When a bank makes a loan to a person, it does not do anything but give him a piece of paper. That piece of paper he's allowed to put a man's name on, and that man can have a figure on there up to a certain amount. Now, that is not money. All that man can do with that piece of paper, check, is to put it back into a bank. And that's not money. It's not money. It's still there in that bank. But the government there's another man who said this in Parliament, and I can get that out of...
Captain Kirby, was it?
No. Boyd Carpenter. It's a man called Boyd Carpenter who says the real inflationary pressure develops, if it does develop, not from the printing of banknotes. And remember, banknotes are government notes. That's government issue from the Treasury. Not from the printing of banknotes, but from the creation of credit. The main vehicle for payments is the cheque, not the banknote. The purpose of the banknote is simply to enable people to cash their cheques. And it is not a conceivable way of restraining inflation to make it impossible for people to cash the cheques they present. Now, the government, therefore, sees to it that that man who put his cheque into that bank, no matter which bank, they're all together, they're all in one in this, and it's up to them to see that they can withdraw that money in notes, in currency, call it currency. Now, when they do that, what is happening is that the government is giving the banks at least seven times as much in total as they have received in deposits. And they are allowing them to do this simply by allowing the people to withdraw their checks. Now, in 19... What happens then is that was a deposit in a bank, and it came about entirely by the bank allowing people to write checks on loans. Now, when the war came in 1914, we were on a gold currency, a gold basis, and the banks were doing this could not pay out when all the people rushed to the banks for their money. They could only pay out a tenth because the government allowed them this one tenth in currency. And they wanted their gold out. They couldn't have it. So all the government did was to print millions of £1 and 10 shilling notes. By doing that, and giving them to the banks. By the way, the banks had given the money. That's another thing that I got.
In exchange for treasury bills.
Yes, they're given the treasury notes. They're given treasury notes to the bank notes.
The bank prints the treasury bill.
No, the Bank of England prints the treasury notes. They can give a cheque for it to the Bank of England, but the actual currency is only issued by the government. That's currency. What they are doing is to get currency back for nothing, for these checks. That's all. And when people have to pay back the money that they've borrowed, they don't give a check for it. They pay that in currency. So all the currency it's coming out as a creation of a bank deposit, but it's going back when the people repay their loans in currency. That's why we're losing currency all the time.
What happens to this currency when it's paid back?
It's destroyed. That's what they tell you. Every loan, when it is paid back, that currency is destroyed.
Not the actual notes.
Well, I think they keep their notes, but the government. I think the Bank of England buys notes back from them somehow, but they don't use them themselves. It is not that the currency that goes in doesn't. They're not allowed to use it themselves because it's a creation. It was a creation of money, and this is a cancellation of. It's a cancellation of the money. If we got a different system, which this man recommends, Professor J.D. Unwin, you'd have to cancel the money as you created it. And he's in my. You don't have this, do you? Tomorrow's World.
No.
Now, that Tomorrow's World is a summary of my thinking about money. It started with Douglas, Douglas and Hattersley. These are the two Hattersley books. It started with Douglas and Hattersley, and then in 1940, I read this. It's called Hafuzia, and nobody's got it because it went in 1940. Nobody read anything, but I managed to get it, and I had to go to the top library to get it at that time. My brother bought it, and when he died, I got it. But this man's system is much more sensible than the present system. Thank you. This is the system that he... Well, let me give you the fourth holiness. There it is. Direct exchange of commodities. Four methods. The four follies. These are the four follies that this Professor J.D. Unwin cites. Folly number one is the idea that no consumer is able to purchase a commodity till he has obtained out of an existing supply the money that expresses the exchange value of that commodity. In other words, you can't buy anything expensive unless you hire the money to buy it. That's the idea, and he says that's an extreme folly, because as soon as wealth appears, money should be there. It should be created to the value of that wealth. But that wealth wears away. All right, then your money shall wear away. The best way to wear money away is to pay for it in installments. You'd be surprised to hear that in Russia, that's exactly what they do. And it's a pity that it isn't known, more of that is not known. About the Russian money.
What exactly do they do in
Russia? I had that from a man, from a Russian teacher who came over to this country to learn our methods of teaching, and I questioned him about this. I said, "What? Where do you put your money when you want to save it?" He said, "In the safety house." I said, "What is it?" He said, and I realised it was a bank. There's only one bank. There's only one bank. It's the National Bank. And I said, "Now, what interest do you get?" He said, 2%. I said, "Now, suppose you want to, you don't want to take it out, but you want to buy something." And I said, "What can you buy?" I said, "A television." He said, "Yes." I said, "A washing machine." He said, "Yes." I said, "A house." He said, "You can, but there aren't many to buy." He's got one, pointing to one of his mates. I said, "Right. Now, if you want to buy that, and you don't want to take, you want to buy a washing machine, shall we say, and you don't want to take the money out of the safety house, how do you buy it? What's the higher purchase?" And he didn't understand the word higher purchase. He thought I meant H-I-G-H-E-R. So I said, "Well, how much more does it cost if you pay for it by week by week?" He said, "Nothing more, it's the same." Now that's the sensible way of buying things, but there's one thing else that this man says. You must phase the money out according to the life of the thing you're buying. In other words, if you buy a car, that car must be guaranteed for X years. And when it's finished, and it's destroyed, and a new one will be ready. Now, there's nothing wrong. That's the only way you can do it. Let me tell you, that's his first idea. And that's the first folly. The second folly consists in the petrification of money and the granting to it of a permanent existence. In other words, once money is issued by banks, it stays issued and it's there all the time and receives interest on it, and it never wears out. In other words, until you repay that, not in bank money, but in currency, it's still there. It's still running. The third folly consists in the issue of money without the production of commodities. Naturally.
Because, yes.
That naturally, that's true. And that in the illustration I gave you of his way of doing it is right. And the Russian way is doing it, isn't it? They're doing it that way in Russia. Because the money is there. And it's only created just as our money is created. And the folly number four is the idea that land is a commodity. In other words, you can buy land, but it isn't a commodity. I've got an article on that in the next issue of Abundance, our paper. Because money is not a commodity. We should be able to use the land for building houses on, for farming it, for mining underneath it. And those should accrue, those on top should accrue to the people who are doing it. And I feel that those... stuff below should accrue to the state, but the land is part of the state, and it will always increase in value in a country like ours because there's so little of it, and that should go back to the whole people, not to a person who buys it. The EEC are now buying our land, and it's crazy to allow them to do so. Mrs. Thatcher is selling our industries, and it's crazy. It really is crazy to do so if we depend upon those industries. If you think about it, let's take that point of industries. In the future, we're going to be run by robots. That's my last man. He's our last man. The robot revolution. Think about it. If robots are financed by financiers, they distribute no wages or salaries, they do all the work, and the products can't be bought by the people because they're not receiving wages and salaries. That's the ultimate. But it's already started. There'll never be fewer people in industry. There'll never be more people in industry than we've got now, because robots are coming up faster, and they're cheaper, and they work longer, and they don't have tea breaks and everything. They can work 24 hours a day. So they're bound to replace people. So there are bound to be no wages going out. So in the first place, people can't buy the products. They'll have to be sent abroad. Neither can the government tax the people in order to pay for the services, like the police, the education, and things of that sort. So that's the other crazy thing that this man said, the four follies. Now,
is that still in print, that book?
No, you can't get hold of it. I've lent this to various people. The last man I offered it to was Harford Thomas last Saturday, because he'd got
getting it reprinted.
No, there will never. It won't be reprinted because it's against the establishment.
There are lots of books printed.
I don't
read this one.
What is it?
It's
Who Makes Our Money? No, I've not read that. I haven't heard of it.
It's more the conspiratorial aspect.
That's South Africa.
No, it's printed in England actually. The author is from
Who Makes Our Money? The medical schemes, who plotted World War One, who other bankers secret rules.
It's basically.
Well, I'll make a note of that. I'll have a note of that before you go.
Well, you can keep it. Actually, I've got three or four copies.
Have you?
Yeah.
Oh well, I'd be pleased to have one.
And
incidentally, I'll give you that one.
Oh.
Which is the sequel to this. I can't give you this because we've only one or two of them left.
Well, if you want to get these things reprinted, there are publishers that will do it. It might cost you a bit like that. So there are publishers.
Publishers.
Oh, yes.
This is the one that ought to be republished. But it doesn't have to be all of it, because the first part of it, would you like to glance through there?
Harpousia,
it means where in Greek. It's a Greek word meaning where. But the fourth, that one, that's his method. That's the economic system as it is run now, the financial system. And this is his. And it's the way I told you. Money is issued when wealth appears. And that's all.
Yeah, there are lots of Bloomfield books, perhaps. Panda. Historical Review Press.
Well, that one.
New Tide Press. Sons of Liberty.
Well, you mean to republish?
Yes, sir.
Well, we've tried to get a sale for this one. For that one. Now, that's absolutely all he recommends of Douglas is a national dividend. And he says it's a necessity. Now, the national dividend is the third point that Douglas makes. You know this one, the social credit.
I've got that, yeah.
Well, you know the three things. Now, that the last one is that. And he saw that in 1920. But he never foresaw the silicon chip. Nobody could have foreseen that.
But he foresaw technology.
He foresaw technology.
As an engineer.
Yes, as an engineer.
They foresaw that the workforce will get smaller and smaller.
Yes, but now it's exploded, isn't it? It's now explosive. And it is important that we should... Well, I've got a book upstairs by some three Danes who recommended a national dividend in Denmark from the age of naught, from birth. You know also of Roberts, Keith Roberts? You don't know of Keith Roberts? Harford Thomas wrote about it in The Guardian last Saturday, about Keith Roberts' book. It's been reprinted in the... he's a member of ours, by the way. I introduced him to this man, to this. Nobody will handle this. He's an American, and when I saw it, I said, this is Douglas, and it's Unwin, Professor Unwin, and I'm going for this book. I've sold 200 of this book in this country, and nobody else has sold any. Bloomfield Books now keeps a few. But I've been pressing this on. It came last year to England and said, I want to meet you, and they came over here and had a word with me. And now I'm trying to get a series. In fact, I'm sending one to Sheffield University today. I want to get it into the post before 12. A copy of the book, asking him if they'll give him a seminar in their department to talk about this book. Now that's that. If we can't get anything else, it's a must. And you don't have to have Douglas, I feel, in order to get a national dividend, because it's for an industrial society, it's the absolute must.
How will this dividend work?
How
will this dividend work?
How will the dividend work?
Yeah.
How will
the government will print money and pay it interest free?
No, they will. No, what they will do will be to finance the automated products. He would invest in the existing things as they are now. He would invest money in those, but. I go farther than he does in saying that the government must do the investing, for the simple reason that if financiers invest in these robots, all the products that we shall only have the possibility of... how are we going to get it? They get all the profits out of it. Well, how can the people benefit from that? But if the government invests in the industries which are producing only those goods that people in this country can use. We must have... Well, if they do invest in those, then all the products can be sold to us. Then the government will have to do as Unwin does and produce the money. They don't produce any money. It's a credit in a way. If a person has bought something, if these products are being turned out for the whole of the people, then they can be monetized at a bank or at the post offices. They can take this. Well, I look upon the building of a house, for instance, as the most important thing that a person usually has to buy in their lifetime. When the builder has built a house and somebody has seen it and would like it and can only pay for it in weekly installments, they agree on a price, then they go to a post office, which is recognised for this thing because it's a national affair, and they've got a man there who will deal with things like this. They say, we've got this, I've built this house, he'd like to buy it, and we've agreed on a price. And then the man behind the hunter said, how long is it going to last? And the builder says it will last so many years, and they'll be selling on the length of time, and he will keep it in the fabric of the house, will be kept over that period. So they divide the cost of the house into the number of weekly payments, and that's the cost of it, plus 1/8 of 1% of the whole thing as a single payment, which is the cost of administration. Now that immediately, what you've got this business starting straight away. The money is there, and it's given to the builder. That is replaced week by week by the man who's bought the house, and it's on weekly payments alone. And if he should leave, the next income, the man he sells the house to, he has to pay exactly the same. Has to pay the exactly the same amount each week until the end of the period, by which time the house is destroyed and another better house is ready for him. It's pulled down. Slums, and there are no interest payments, and the whole thing is a matter of money equating with wealth. Now, that was the second man I came to, which was built on Douglas. In fact, when I read a report, a review of this book, in The Listener in 1940, when we were at war, if you remember, and I kept saying, "This is Douglas. Douglas." And then when I got to the bottom, it said, "The ideas presented by Professor J.D. Unwin are very similar to those announced by Douglas, C.H. Douglas, under the name of social credit."
Now, let's talk a bit about this irredeemable debt. Money, almost all money, comes into circulation as loans.
As loan.
And loans.
Almost. It is all. All does. All that the government does is to allow people to withdraw it from the banks.
Yep.
As loans and overdrafts.
There is a small amount which does not come in as loans, isn't it? The money banks pay their own staff, for example.
Well, yes, there is that. I hadn't thought of that.
But if
the banks make a purchase, that is also done on credit. That is new money too.
But it's not when the banks purchase something, though. It's not they don't create a debt.
If they pay for it by a cheque, then it is new money.
Well, let me put it this way: if the government or local authority wants to build, say, a bridge across the local river,
if the local authority wants to build a bridge, yes,
they borrow £1 million.
Yes.
From the bank. They go to the bank, and the bank writes them a cheque for £1 million.
Yes.
And they pay that back up.
It's
interest.
Yes.
Now, say the bank wants to build a bridge instead.
But they don't. They say they want to build new premises.
Yeah.
They want to build new premises.
For £1 million.
Yes. Well, they pay cheques out to the builders. Mm-hmm. And those cheques are new credits. That is an increase in the...
It's not an increase in the national debt, though.
It isn't an increase...
It's not an increase in debt, really, is it? Because the banks are really giving back money.
It's an increase in wealth that's being produced by cheques, by credit.
Yeah, but it's not... It's an increase in wealth, but it is not... a liability.
Well, there's no liability in that. No.
If I can take the money trick.
Yes. It tells you there in the money trick how they purchase buildings.
By honouring their own checks.
They are honouring their own checks.
Not a bad idea, is it?
No, it isn't. Well, it becomes. You see, every check becomes a deposit in a bank somewhere. It doesn't matter what bank it's in. It's only bank money until whoever has the name on the cheque wishes to withdraw it, and then he can only withdraw it in currency, which is the only thing. People think that because the Bank of England creates money in the form of notes and coin, that they are creating our money, but they are not. They are only making it possible for people who have new deposits in banks to
It says here a bank's premises cost it nothing. We have stated that most money comes into circulations of debt to the banks. We say most of it does. The only money that does not originate is the debt to the banks. It's the money banks use in their own purchases.
Yes, that's the. But that a purchase of a.
All money that a bank spends on its own behalf, whether it is the payment of its employees' salaries, the purchase of a building site, a building, stock shares, printing, advertising, station, etc. All such purchases put money into circulation, debt-free.
Yes.
But with these exceptions, it's correct to say that the bulk of the community's money begins its life as a debt to the banks.
Yes, well, that's that.
That's interesting, that. That's very interesting. That leaves a way out of the system. Money comes into circulation as debt, as loans, and loans are debt. Now, how much longer is this going to go on? Our national debt now is, what, £80,000 million, is it?
I think it's 100. It's gone 100. Up to 100. It was 95 when Wilfred Price wrote to me this week. In his little book, it's 95. What's his little book called? Bring all the books down. What did you say there?
How long is this going to go on?
It can only burst. Let me go back to a talk I gave in Canada, in the United States. I was over there talking about social credit across the continent, across Canada. And then I came down the coast to stay with an old friend of ours. And then I went to Asheville, where one of our members was, and I told him I was coming. He said, right, I'll get somebody for you to talk to. And one of the people I spoke to was the direct descendant of Jefferson. And another was an economist who had taught at Harvard. And now I told them that it would be absolutely necessary in view of the automation that's rapidly occurring now to distribute wages some other way, and instead of wages to distribute money in another way, and it must be in the form of a dividend. Now, when I'd finished, he never questioned me, but other people did. But when it was over, I thought, well, that's the end of questioning. And he said, I don't doubt the truth of everything you've told us, but I don't think it'll work. So I said, what then would you put in its place? And he paused for a minute. He said, I think the economy will collapse, or there will be a war. Now, I hung on to that or. Because, you see, wars are decided by people, by politicians. If politicians see collapse coming and the alternative being a war, what will they choose? They'll choose a war.
Let's imagine there isn't a war, though. What will...
How would the collapse occur?
The only way the national debt can be... What incidentally is the interest on the national debt now?
Oh, it's 100 million. It's 100 million a year. Wait a minute, it's a lot more than that. I can't give you the figures, but it's tremendous, and it's getting more. It gets more all the time. But don't you see that the present system, the present condition of this country, is such that it's heading towards collapse now. It really is heading towards collapse. I can't see the bankers allowing it to collapse. But it's only they who can stop it. By stopping this system, I think.
Right. Now, supposing I'm a businessman and I borrow £10,000 from the bank. I can't pay it back. They'll make me bankrupt. What happens?
You go on adding the interest that you should be paying.
They make me bankrupt now. So what happens? I go to court and they say, what do they do then?
Say that again?
If I'm declared bankrupt, what happens?
Well, you're sold up. And they have to have what they can get from it, from the proceeds of the bankruptcy sale.
This is everything I've got.
Yes, that's all. That's.
And then, if that still doesn't meet what I owe, what happens then?
Well, if you're declared bankrupt, you can't give them any more. And
eventually it's written off.
They'll write that off, but it's nothing to write off.
Right.
They're finished with interest. What they're more interested in is interest.
Right.
Now, the government... Yes?
Eventually, though, it'll be written... I mean, Stonehouse did this, didn't he? He was made bankrupt, something like 50,000. And it was written off. What happens if a nation goes bankrupt, though?
Well...
What can the banker do then?
It's said that a nation can't go bankrupt. But I'm not sure that a nation can't go bankrupt. We should go bankrupt if automation took over. Because we wouldn't be able to buy the goods that are being produced, and we wouldn't be able to tax the people to pay for all the services that we must have. Services that we must have. We should go bankrupt in that case. But
what would happen then?
I don't know.
Would the banks demand everything? Would they confiscate?
Oh, the banks would go down as well. They wouldn't be able to operate in a country which could not borrow from them. And what are they borrowing? The government can still create its own currency and would still be doing so, I suppose. But, and now, the overseas, do you know the overseas news? They've shown how, by the banks creating money for the wars, they've shown how silly that is, and we should cancel them. I say that any war loan, and most four-fifths of war loan is held by banks, any war loan that banks hold, because it was a creation of money, and we paid for it over and over again. I tell you how we pay for it in a war. In the 1914-18 war, with a at £700 million was the amount of our national debt at that time. Now, they created all the money for the war, and at the end of it, and they lent people money to buy the war loan, and they held the war loan as security for the loans. And at the end of it, the war loan was £7,000 million. It was more than 7,000 million. So you can say they'd increased the amount of money by 7,000 million. Now, they then said that's a debt. It wasn't a debt, because it was spent on goods that there were very little to buy on, and the inflation. We paid for it in inflation, and the inflation was 50% in 4 years. I know this one ever so well. And therefore... We should have cancelled that, because there was no real wealth at all. It was just money. It was just credit all the time.
The national debt now, you say, is something like £100,000 million.
Yes.
Which is owed just to the banks.
Is it just
to the banks, or most of it to the banks?
Well, the banks try to sell war loan to people. When the war's over. I know a man who was in the school I was in. He said, my bank manager told me to buy war loan. He said, the best thing to do after when the war was over, he said, buy war loan. Why? Because they've got it all. And they wanted their image to be improved. So they asked their clients to buy war loan. It was good, but it wasn't a good speculation at all.
Yeah. The national debt, though. The banks hold all the national debt. Not just the war loan, but the national debt.
Well, the national debt is mainly caused by wars, and we haven't paid for any of them yet. So it's nearly all.
So they're owed nearly 100,000.
They're owed nearly 100,000.
Which is in this country, the big four, presumably, it's NatWest, Barclays.
Yes, it's the...
Lloyds.
Yes, all the banks are in it, because they work together all. But they also
they
work with other banks abroad now.
Now, you say this leaflet, basically, that...
What is this?
This is...
it wants to bring it up today. Yes, the absurdity of the national debt.
But... this could be got rid of, basically, by printing the money, paying it to the banks and sending them to destroy it.
Yeah, it could.
Just like that.
Well, there is a way of doing it. I'm not clear about the way of doing it. But the banks created one-tenth of all the money that was wanted to allow people to withdraw if they wanted to. They millions, hundreds of millions they had to distribute, but they said to the people, don't withdraw it, buy war loan with it, with your deposits in the bank.
And what exactly is the war loan? It's part of the national debt.
Oh, it's the most important, it's the biggest part of the national debt.
So it's your security.
Of all the wars that have gone, because nothing is allowed to interfere with it, but the banks insist on calling it a debt.
What interest do people get on this debt?
I don't know what the rate is. I don't know what the rate for war loan is.
Is it certificate? They buy certificates, do they?
Yes, it's a certificate. But as I say, when they lent money to buy them, they allowed them 1% and they took 4%, and that was in 1914. That was a 5% loan. And they took 4% and they allowed people to have 1%, but they kept the war loan as security. And when they couldn't repay after the war, as they couldn't, and most of them, so they said, right, we'll have to keep the war loan now, and they got the full 5% interest. They never lose. They can't lose. This was first written, by the way, by a millionaire. I forgot his name now. I just brought it up.
Part of the national debt could be wiped out by... In the first place, a clear distinction should be drawn between those who have bought their holdings of the national debt with money they have saved, earned, inherited, or otherwise normally acquired.
That is, yes.
And those who have bought their holdings with newly created money, i.e. the banks, and those bankers' nominees who have been granted bank loans wherever to make their purchases.
Yes.
Banks should be ordered to sell their holdings of government securities to the state, which is a matter of bookkeeping, would pay them with newly created non-debt money. This money, in accordance with existing banking practice, the banks would then be required to destroy. Just as under the present system, they create new money when making loans or buy securities, so do they destroy money when they receive repayment of principal of loans or sell securities, keeping only interest themselves. Why isn't that being done? It says here, if this action were taken, a part of the national debt would be wiped out immediately without any risk of inflation.
Why isn't it done? Because the banks don't like it. Don't like to think of it.
Well, what if Mr. Wedgwood Benn were to stand up in Parliament and say we should do this? What sort of support would he get?
I don't think he'd get any. Because they won't think about it.
Who won't think about it?
Ask any MP. I sent 50 years of social credit. I sent to every member of parliament and nobody replied.
Every member?
Mm.
Not one of
somebody.
Them? When was it?
Somebody gave us the money to send it to them.
When was this?
1969, I think.
Nobody replied?
Nobody replied. They don't want to know. They don't want to know anything about money. They leave it all to the bankers. And that's why we're in the mess we're in. That's why I say we ought to try to persuade individuals to think about this matter.
And but perhaps social creditors should make more noise.
Well, how are we going to make it?
Well, we see what CND do and the anti-apartheid movement and other people like that and make a lot of noise.
I think we've got to persuade that people don't like being hammered. I think we've got to persuade people to think. And I think the new robots, that the effect of the robots will force people to think. How are we going to buy the things the robots can turn out? And they can even mine coal from below now. on the surface rather that robots can. How are we going to buy the products that the robots are going to see if we don't receive wages? And there's only one way to do it, and that is to receive dividends. And if we're receiving dividends on production, the government must have some hand in that production. Anyway, it's time I was moving to get...
Right, we were talking about before countries going bankrupt. You said that no country had ever gone bankrupt.
Well, the bankers maintain that countries can't go bankrupt. That's one of the things that I've heard the bankers say this, that only firms in countries go bankrupt. The country can't. But I think they're wrong now. I think of Brazil and one or two of these South American states is in the process. The country itself is in such a parlous state that they could be set to be, that the country itself could set to be bankrupt. After all, if all industries are nationalised, surely the country goes bankrupt. If the businesses go bankrupt, and I mean if a country borrows on its own account and then fritters away the money as Brazil has done, because they had oil, because they had an asset, they were given money by the bankers, that was frittered away and is now lost. So in a way, they're almost bankrupt themselves. Through taking on loans and not being able to...
The system, though, is one of irredeemable debt. The only way debt can be paid is by more and more loans.
That's all.
So the loans can never be paid off?
No.
Never.
No, they shouldn't. Neither should they be, because there's no fact about that. There's no existence in fact. It's a myth. They're lending nothing and expecting back national currency, which they can't do.
So it's a little bit absurd, really, isn't it?
There is something queer about it, because international banks do have some relation to gold. I think there is some gold is involved in some of it.
But there is a great sort of community of interest, though, between the bankers.
Oh yes, they all work together. Yes.
And they have their own bankers.
And if one is going down, the others all run to their...
They have their own bankers bank in Switzerland, I believe, the Bank of International Settlements.
That's the Bank of International... That's right. that's the bankers bank. And the other one is the Bank of International Settlements. There's another... The other consortium of bankers is the... I don't know where that's housed. What's that one called?
We're not talking about the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
The World Bank. It's called the World Bank. That's the International Monetary Fund. The Bank of International Settlements is one of the groups higher up, if you like. This is the basic, that one.
Yeah. Now, can we talk a little bit about foreign aid and about trade? Bankers are all in favour of trade, particularly between East and West, and a lot of this has been one way. Basically, what happened with the communist bloc, for example, when trading with the communist bloc, was that banks would arrange credits for export markets,
yes,
and arrange, say, $500 million credits, which would be given to the Soviet Union to buy goods from the West.
Or they'd be given to the people exporting, to allow them to export it. I don't know. But it's got to be paid as from the USSR, so presumably it's a credit. which they're supposed to be honouring. The USSR must honour that credit if wealth goes from one of the Western countries.
But some of these loans at such ridiculous rates of interest and repayable over such a long period of time, that, well, the question must be asked, why not just create the credits and give them to the community?
Why not indeed? Because of what but they see, there's the matter of interest. The interest is the important thing to them, to the bankers. Because once a loan is repaid, they're finished. I mean, they don't get the money back. So it's just cancelled.
So the idea is not to have the loan repaid, but to up to its ears in debt that it can never repay.
That's right. Well, that's what they're aiming, to keep them paying interest on debts.
Is it true that the countries, the respective countries of the world, owe the bankers more than all the money in existence?
Well, if you look at this little book, The Money Trick, what happens in Australia, it's the same all the world over. It's the bankers who are owned. Well, they're bound to get control of everything by the way the money system works, I think.
Well, one thing we hear from the left a lot is nationalisation. But the Bank of England was theoretically nationalised in 1946.
Yes, it was. And we did get the sort of note about it, how it worked, what happened at the time that it was nationalised. But what that did, It just didn't do what we hoped it would do. That is, that the banks would do the creation of money, that bank would do the creation of money that the commercial banks are doing.
What if all the banks were nationalised? Would the national debt disappear then?
Yes, I should think it could. Now look, this is only what I think. If you nationalised a bank, you'd get all their resources and all their debts, and the debts could be cancelled. That's what ought to be done. Where every bank, every war loan that's held by any bank, and any war loan that's held by any bank, is the result of what two things? The first is that they bought it themselves, which is on credit. The other is that they've allowed somebody else to buy it on loan from them, and then they have forfeited it. Those are the two things. And therefore, if all the banks were nationalised, those could all be cancelled without any trouble at all.
And the strange thing is, though, we find that as far as nationalisation goes, the bankers have a long record of promoting this themselves, promoting collectivism. Bank of England is theoretically nationalised. The Federal Reserve System is meant to be nationalised. In fact, it's not.
It isn't. No, those
it's a private consortium. So, yes. So too is the Bank of England.
I don't think you can say that the Bank of England is a private consortium.
But it's still the same people are controlling it, more or less, isn't it?
It's what they're doing. It doesn't matter who the people are involved in it is how they are operating, and they're not operating any differently from the way they were when they were privately owned. In other words, the country is not allowed to create its own money. That's true. All they do is to give currency to the banks who are creating deposits. That's all. That's the way it's working. And it's still going the same way.
So we go over that again, the creation of money. When the government prints money, coins and notes,
it's printing currency.
It's printing currency.
Banks don't issue currency. They only issue loans which become deposits in banks.
So what happens to this currency when it leaves the mint?
It's given to the banks. It's given to the banks. That's what this man told me. I said, they don't pay for it. He said, no, it's given to us. In other words...
Is that in exchange for treasury bills?
I don't know whether they give anything in the way of credit for it.
According to the money, treasury bills are gilt-edged securities.
Yes. So it says. But as I see currency working, it is only used to allow people who have been the credits in banks more than the deposits that they have been put into them by people, it's to allow them to cash those, as that instance I told you about the First World War proved.
But can we now talk a little bit about financial reform? There have been attempts to reform the financial system. Abraham Lincoln, during the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln was tried to borrow money from the bankers, and they tried charging 28% to 36%. So basically, what Lincoln said was, "Get stuff, we'll print our own," and he did exactly that, didn't he?
Yes. He did.
He printed
greenbacks.
$346 million, was it?
Yes. Well, that's fully documented in the Money Trick.
And that money was spent into circulation, debt-free, interest-free, and has not cost the United States a penny.
In that First World War, that was debt-free until the war was over, and then the banks made the government change it into a debt. That really was debt-free.
Are you saying the First World War? How did this come about? Did the government adopt a free money policy?
No, there was a run on the banks because people feared for their gold. It was gold then, and they feared for their money, and rightly so, because the banks were issuing more than they'd got, and so there was no government can allow the banks to go bust. So the government came in and closed the banks. That stopped people withdrawing their money. At first they tried to give them money in pennies to eke out the time that it took them to give them out in shillings and things like that. But then the government did close the banks. Then they told the people that they would be open on a day or two, and in the meantime they'd had hundreds of millions of pound notes printed instead of gold. Gold went right off them. I can remember going shopping with gold, by the way. That gold went right off the market, and people were told not to withdraw their money, but to put it into, if they got any savings, please put it into the war effort, as everybody else was trying to do.
Did this cause inflation, all this printing money?
Exactly, because there was, in wartime, it's waste you're making. You're making colossal waste. People are earning high wages making colossal waste, but there's so little to spend their money on that it was exactly 50% in 4 years. So everybody's savings, or whatever they'd got, was reduced by 50% in those 4 years.
Now, what about the Second World War? It says here that the government, by a cheap money policy, prevented...
It was a 3.5% war. That was a 3.5% war instead of a 5%.
Where is it? World War II was a 3% war.
That's right.
By a cheap money policy, the government prevented the public debt service from becoming a ball and chain at the ankle of the post-war economy. What does that mean, a cheap money policy?
Instead of a 5% money was available at 5% in the First War. Money was available at 3% in the Second War. Therefore, instead of a huge, well, it was big enough, because at the end of the war, the national debt, which had been 7,000 millions until the war began, jumped at the end of the war to 35,000 million.
Yeah, this was a cheap money policy of 3%. Yes. The government said to the banks, right, you will print money at 3%, you will create loans at 3%.
They insisted that the bank rate was down to that so that they could, it would be a 3% or 3.5%.
On the other hand, they could have said money at 0%, couldn't they?
Yes, they could. Just the same.
Just like that.
They could have done that.
They could do that now, in fact.
Yes.
They could say, you will create loans at 0%.
For things that matter. Yes, they could do that now.
And so why the hell don't they?
No, that's what I can't understand. It's because they've still got the idea that money is something of value. But it isn't. It isn't of value at all. If you use money properly, all it does is to facilitate getting one wealth and another bargained for. It's like barter. It eases barter by allowing you to do it that way. He's got the best idea for that.
So, if the government were to say to the banks tomorrow, you will create £5 billion of loans at 0% interest.
And they would be devoted to?
To public works projects.
The public works projects and products which are consumable by the people.
That could be done.
That could be done.
With no harm to the economy, and indeed benefit to the economy.
Benefit to the economy. Well, what Douglas would suggest, put new money in. It's just the same thing.
Exactly the same thing, yes.
It is the same thing. But he says there's a shortage of money. All right. Put money in until it's until you've got the balance. Right. Whereas this man does it right at the retail counter, so to speak. He does it by having the second thing. Fractional... What do they call it?
Fractional reserve.
No, not fractional reserve. But every retailer would give a discount according to a figure that's a fraction, which is how much money is to indicate how much money is wanted, and they do it that way. Whereas this man says, "There's the wealth. There's the man who wants it. Agree about it, and don't pawn it. All the banks do is to pawn everything." Mortgage everything instead of putting money into everything.
What about taxing the banks? What if the government were to impose a tax on the banks?
But it wouldn't do the public any good unless the government. I think the public has to have it, not the government.
What if the government says, right, you will pay us £50 billion tax tomorrow? Would that
That would upset a lot of things, because I think it'll have to be done gradually. The first thing to do is to say, I'm sure, every bond, every war bond that you own from the Boer War and the other wars before that, every bond that you have in your possession, you will hand over to us, and therefore you will receive no more on it, and they will cancel them. That's the first thing to do, because every war has to be financed in this way. Nobody wants to know you in war, so you have to provide your own. Government doesn't. The banks will do it.
They can always provide money for war.
Yes.
Always.
Every time.
Every time.
And that's why, if they're given the choice of a collapse of the economy and a war, they'll have a war, but they'll get the money from the banking system. Whereas they could get the money themselves.
Is it true that we're still paying money on the original national debt from 1694?
Yes.
We're still paying interest.
Well, we may be pretending to pay some of it off, but certainly the Boer War and the Crimean War and the First World War and the Second World War, all those are still extant. Some people have them. Some people have loans. They've bought with their own savings. And those ought to be allowed to be, but anything held by the banks, which means it's either bought by them or it was loaned to people to buy the war loan, and then it was forfeited by them.
Right, now what other attempts have been made? Abraham Lincoln, we all know what happened to Abraham Lincoln, don't we? He got shot by
Yes, he was shot.
Who else has tried to...
Well, we've had various schemes, like... I have a book...
Guernsey.
The Guernsey Experiment. Now, that's a clear-cut case, and I want that republishing, by the way. And it's not a very big one. It can be, that could be republished by one of your people fairly cheaply, I should imagine, because that does catch on.
I think it's still in print. It's still in print. I've seen it advertised.
That was the one that was done by... that was done by one of our members, Olive and Jan Grubiak. They were foreigners, but they were naturalised English, and they did that one.
Can you tell me a bit about the Guernsey? Oh, Salvation Island, I've read that.
Oh, well, yes, that's...
Good, is it?
Tell you a bit about it. I can let you have one of the few copies.
Well, for this, to summarise it, what happened in Guernsey?
They were in debt to the banks. And
when was this?
Oh, I can't tell you the dates.
Approximately.
Just shut it off a minute and let me find out when they first met. At the beginning of the 19th century, after the Napoleonic Wars, Guernsey was in dire straits. Precious little else but beauty and a pleasant climate to attract visitors. Deep roads were mere cart tracks, 4'6" wide. Town was ill-paved, unattractive. No trade, no hope of employment for the poor. The sea was fast encroaching on the land. The state's debt of 19,137 bore an annual interest charge of 2,390, and the annual revenue was only 3,000. So you can see, that's all. The net revenue from all sources was therefore only £600 a year. This while the dike project alone was estimated at over 10,000.
So what did they do?
After grave deliberation, the committee reported in 1816 with this historic recommendation that property should be acquired and a covered market should be erected. The expense to be met by the issue of state's notes to the value of £6,000. That was it. A public market which had neither cover nor shelter, and it was found that further taxation was impossible. Borrowing money would incur debt charges at a high interest rate, which they neither could afford, and that's what they did. This is the committee's report. The committee recommends that the expense should be met by the issue of state's notes of £1 sterling to the value of 6,000, and that these notes will be available not only for the payment on the new market, but also for Torteville Church, roads to construct, and other expenses of the state. When one considers that the banks already have their notes in circulation for more than 50,000, whereas it is now proposed to restrict the state's issue to a mere 6,000, and then that's dots after that. There was also no argument the issue would provide a permanent revenue to the state sufficient not only to provide for the erection of the market, but also to create an amortization fund to extinguish the debt of the states.
Did that extinguish it?
To wipe it out. An amortization fund. Wait a minute. Without increasing the state's debt, it will be possible to finish these works, leaving sufficient money in the exchequer for other needs. It was not until 1819 that the committee was successful in financing the building of a new market, and the state's notes issued for this purpose was 4,500, redeemable in 10 years out of import duties and the revenue from butcher shops. This issue was quickly followed by others, and in 1821 the number of notes in circulation was increased on the committee's recommendation to £10,000. It had been the most advantageous method of meeting debts from the point of view both of the public and the state's finances. The public seemed to realise this fact, and far from being averse to taking the notes, they sought them out eagerly. The new markets were finally opened in October 1822. In 1824, a further £5,000 was authorised for the markets, and in 1826, the issue was increased to a total of £20,000 to erect Elizabeth College and certain parochial schools. It was in this year also that the first States of Guernsey £5 notes appeared. By 1829, the States notes issue in circulation exceeded 48,000, and by 1837, 55,000 was the grand total. And it was stated over and over again by eminent men of those times that without the issue of States notes, important public works such as roads and buildings could not possibly have been carried out. Yet by means of the States issue, not only were these works accomplished, but the island was not a penny the poorer in interest charges. Indeed, the improvements that stimulated the flow of visitors to the island, and with increased trade the island enjoyed a newfound prosperity.
That's from the Guernsey experiment.
That's from the Guernsey experiment. That's by Gannon. We issue a one which was first done by Edward Holloway, who prints a little quarterly.
So what happened to Guernsey then?
It's all right. They're still running the two sorts of together. There are Bank of England, there are the banks from the continent, from here, from the country, and there are their own notes running alongside each other.
But they still print their own notes.
They still print their own notes,
and
the banks issue their own notes as well.
There's no national debt for Guernsey.
No, there won't be. I shouldn't think there'd be a national debt now.
So it's a debt-free economy. And a prosperous island.
Yes, it's a prosperous island which first began by printing its own notes. And you can have another thing in the Australian one, in this one, about the
Alberta.
No, it's the Australian one. The Labour Party pushed a bill through quickly which allowed a bank to be formed, and it tells you how rich that bank became.
Oh, the Rural Bank.
The Rural Bank. What page is that on?
I can't remember. It's an incredible story of the Rural Bank.
Bank, page 43. It was a savings bank up to 1948. Its branches in 1947 numbered 58, valued at £1.33 million, and its assets totaled £74 million. 1,327,430, and its assets totaled £74 million. Then, in 1948, a dramatic change took place. The Federal Labour Government, under Prime Minister Shipley, introduced a bill to nationalise the trading banks. The threat alarmed the Government of New South Wales, the Labour Government. So while Mr Shipley's legislation was being before Parliament, the New South Wales Labour Government rushed a very short bill through all stages within one day's sitting of Parliament. This bill's purpose was to change the constitution of the Rural Bank from a virtual savings bank into a bank of issue, that is to say, a bank which had the power to create credit. Now, think the result of that. In a few years, a bank, being a bank of issue, it's increased its assets amazingly. Valuable corner sites have been acquired for premises in the city of Sydney and all the leading country towns. In 1956, it had 110 branches, its assets had jumped to 138 million, and its disclosed reserves to over 20 million. That's the sort of thing that happens when a state takes over one of its banks.
What happened in Alberta? In Canada?
It was not possible to implement any financial change at all, because no state is allowed anything to do with finance. All they did was to institute treasury branches, but there was no money available. They could not create any money as the banks were doing. So that's why that fell. Well, it didn't fall. They gave very good government. In fact, they were the only one that didn't have a sales tax, and they wiped out their state debt before they were turned out.
What exactly did they do, though? They stopped the banks.
They didn't stop anything. They couldn't do anything.
So how did they wipe out their debt?
Well, they managed frugally. They took care of what they were doing, and they finally managed to wipe out the state debt. There wasn't a debt when they left office, because they looked after things carefully, but they had to do it according to the normal way of doing things. They couldn't do otherwise. Mind, I think they got some oil revenues, I'm not sure which helped.
Donald Martin told me that it was his opinion and the opinion of certain other people who were well informed that the whole theory of Keynesian economics had been produced to fuck off the theories of Serge Douglas. What exactly is Keynesian economics?
Keynesian economics. Well, Keynes came out in the Depression. What he suggested, that you shouldn't try to balance the books in the Depression, but you should go below the line. And if you go below the line, what do? You put more money out. You put a lot more money out, because people can't buy things unless they do. I don't know how it worked, but they did go below the line and didn't balance their books. And so by not balancing their book, there was more money available at the time. But it did help, because there was a real shortage. But after a time, it became necessary to withdraw that, so Keynesianism wouldn't work under all circumstances. That was the thing of it. It seemed to me. There's this one. New Society. That it tells you something about that in this one. Major Douglas, money and the major technology. And there's something in there about that one. Those two weren't in there.
What were Douglas's political views?
He wasn't in favour of political parties at all.
The land for the chosen people racket starts off with a quote from the Protocols of Zion.
Yes, it will. I have my doubts about the Protocols of Zion.
Well, it's rather an amusing forgery, of course, but I couldn't quite understand what he was getting at. The aristocracy of the Goyim as a political force is dead, I think the quote started. What were Douglas's views on this?
I don't know. I can't tell you. The only things I've read of Douglas are his economic democracy, social credit, and little pamphlets all over. But they're so difficult. I find Douglas very difficult to read. But at the end of it, I think, now, have I got hold of this correctly? And I have to go back to it. So I wouldn't venture on his ideas about anything, really, except the main social credit scheme, which is outlined in that little book, in that little thing that you've got, Social Credit Principles. Those three principles are still as important today, more so, than they were when he outlined them. And no attempt is being made to follow them. Credits are never never used by the people. It's always a mortgage from a bank. You know, the banks can wipe the building societies out completely if they wish to.
How?
Just let their loans to people at 1% less than the amount that building societies have to charge the public for their funds.
Well, how much do the building societies have to charge?
Whatever it is, whatever the rate is, whatever the bank rate is. But you see, they have to use real money. They have to use savings.
Oh, do they though? Do they?
Unless they're a bank, they do. They can't get money from anywhere else, can they?
Well, I'm not absolutely sure, but I know that in the States, with these credit card companies and I think a new act has been passed, everybody seems to be in the act of making funny money. Are all building societies' assets real then?
Building assets, yes, building society assets are real. They put 1% or 1.5% or 2% on all the money they borrow from the people. They've got to do, but the banks don't have to do that at all. They can charge whatever they like. Why do they allow their own employees to have to build houses at interest rates of 2, 3, 4%, which they do? How can they do that? Well, of course,
well,
they
can. Building societies offer similar facilities and cheap mortgages to start with.
To start? A mortgage?
To staff, yeah.
To the staff. I don't know whether they do or not.
Yes.
Well, they're in the house business, you might say, and they do it because of that. But they do get their funds from the people. They are real funds. They are not created money because they're not banks. And
they're not allowed by law to make a profit on them, really.
Well, there's no control over the bankers by law that they can't undercut the building societies, and they could undercut them by any amount they liked.
The government.
The government might.
The government fixes bank rate, doesn't it?
Yes, but don't you see that if they're giving loans to people to buy houses, it's new money, it's a new credit in a bank, it's a new deposit. Every you've got to keep hold of that one. Because every loan and every overdraft becomes a deposit in a bank and can be withdrawn by an individual. So they can actually wipe them out. There'd be a tremendous outcry if they did, but everybody would transfer to banks. But the banks would only just cut them down because they'd get as much as they possibly could. And in all probability, when they'd wipe them out, they'd raise the rate again. I can see that happening. Anyway, that's where we are for that one.
Another thing which heard it said that people think during the war there was a scheme, I think by the Nazis or somebody, to flood a country with fake money. The idea has been spread that let's suppose that a gang of crooks perfected a printing press where they could print perfect money. The idea has been spread that this would cause a great inflation. On the other hand, if
it all depends how it's distributed, isn't it?
Yeah, but would this, on the other hand, be beneficial? Let's suppose that a gang of counterfeiters printed, not necessarily notes, but pressed 50 pence pieces or the new pound coins, and spent £200-300 million into circulation, if that were possible. That would have a beneficial rather than a detrimental.
It all depends how they do it. If they do it democratically to everybody, if they could give it to everybody, it would be, because it's everybody who is wanting it. It could, if there were too much, it would cause prices to go up by competition, and that would, there would be an inflation. But if it were done democratically, like a national dividend, if everybody got it, that would be right. And I think you could create money to start a national dividend in this way, just to ease the situation while we're in these dire straits.
Looking at this whole thing, though, it's a lot bigger than... It's a lot bigger than, say, the protocol, isn't it? I mean, there's a whole, like I said, there's a community of interest, but it appears to be almost all the big bankers in the world are conspiring.
Yes,
I mean, they all meet in Washington every year, don't they?
Yes, I think they are the people who have the control over the issue of money. The government has no control over the issue of money at all.
What do you make of that article? Suggesting basically that they're panicking. Would you agree in principle with that article?
I think I would. How could they do it?
Well, look, the way I see it, and there's fairly strong evidence for this, is that the whole debt is irredeemable, but with the so-called third world, that bottomless drain between Eastern Europe and China, it's even more irredeemable, that they've got no chance at all of getting their money back, and they pour billions into the Congo, Zaire, and to other banana republics.
Yes.
All they've done is produce famine and rip the places up. What they've done is they've lent billions to these countries to get them in their debt. They've overthrown stable governments, in particular Rhodesia and all the other colonies. They've done this under the banner of so-called Uhuru. They've bankrupted these countries. They've got no chance of getting their money back. Now they realise that this crisis in Mexico, as soon as a significant number of countries don't repay their debts, the whole banking system is going to collapse.
Yes.
So what they're trying to do now is bring the whole world under their control, with the civilised world, i.e. the white world, in particular the West, America,
yes, the
and
West.
Europe,
yes.
Underwriting the debts of these countries.
Well, that's what they're having to do, isn't it?
Which will lead to a sharp reduction in our standard of living. Isn't that what the recession is all about?
But it isn't benefiting, our recession isn't benefiting anybody. It isn't benefiting the poorer peoples.
No.
The poorer peoples live when the others are doing well.
Right.
The prevention of protectionism, protecting, they have to protect their own industries. Everybody's trying to do that now. And it gets fallen down because they can't agree about this.
But what it's been suggested that this recession is to condition us for a world government.
Well, I don't think so. I think Thatcher honestly thinks she's doing her best for this country.
But the idea of a world recession now is absurd, isn't it?
Why there should be a world recession now is absurd. Because we've got the means of producing all the wealth we can
Precisely,
do.
Yeah. How can everybody in the world go bankrupt? It's absurd. There are millions of people sitting around who've got no jobs to do. There's many assets as before. That is what Douglas said, is wealth. Wealth is not money, it's not paper. Wealth is labour, it's commodities, stuff like that.
Yes.
Grains of fields of wheat.
Yes, that's
warehouses
right.
full of clothes.
Wealth is not money.
So the recession then is it's either an accident or it's deliberate. If it's an accident, it's because there's a fundamental flaw in the system. They could be put right tomorrow, but if they put it right, they would lose their power.
Well, as far as this country goes now, we are not competitive. And Thatcher set out to make us competitive. And everything she's done has been done to try to make us competitive. And in doing so, she's killed off the good ones as well as bad ones. But we are down there. It is that's brought us to this. She really thinks that once we get competitive, we can go on. But we shall never be competitive because we can't hope to be as competitive in the things we are making as Japan.
Or sweated labour in Ceylon or somewhere.
Well, Japan, you see, they're good products. They can produce better things than anybody else now. At first they copied, but now they are producing better things, cheaper than anybody else. And so long as this system goes on, anybody who can produce for slightly higher in price, well, they've just lost out, that's all. We should concentrate on ourselves, on producing for our own use. And that would mean a sort of protection.
A programme of economic nationalism, in fact.
Yes, I think some sort of nationalism is necessary for all countries. And the barter, a near barter system without any
excess
in mortgaging of anything. The mortgaging is the thing that's wrong. You can't, it's counting money as value. And money hasn't value unless there's wealth. And money should only be used. He's got it. Unwin's got it. Right. You produce the money as soon as the wealth is there. He says there's no question about which came first, the hen or the egg, in the case of wealth and money. The wealth must come first, and the money comes after. Here, we give credit to the producer to produce and take mortgaging until he's got the production, and then he's got to pay the money back in the costs of the things, which is ridiculous.
Yes, because with the interest,
we pay for a house four times over when it could be paid for once. He will pay for it once.
There must always be a shortage of capital. This is why we get this boom and bust.
There's no shortage of capital.
No, what I mean is that as money, as all money comes into circulation as a debt.
Yes.
It can never complete the cycle, as it were, without losing something.
Somebody loses somewhere. So
under the present system, there must always be not enough money in circulation to pay for goods.
And this is the point.
And this is where you get
from the beginning.
You get these boom and bust cycles and wars, which are an inevitable consequence.
I think so. He forecast the First World War 5 years before it began. And he said if this money system continues by 1940, we should be engaged in a war of such magnitude that civilization could be destroyed, and it nearly was. And he was dead right on the start. And you could foresee the next one. And if things go out according to plan, and if nobody alters the money system, there will be a war after this. Because you get right down there, and there's only one thing they can do as this man set to be in America, or there'll be a war. The economy will collapse, or there'll be a war. And you hope that the next war will be fought on gentlemanly terms instead of with napalm bombs, with the other sort of bombs that will wipe everybody out. So somebody has to make a move somewhere. And people have got to learn about this jolly quickly. As you said, after you'd read this money trick. The money trick. We have to do something quickly. It's all over. It's all held by the bankers themselves. But if little Guernsey can do it, it should be possible for any other country to do it.
We know who these bankers are. happening in Britain, for example. How many men are we talking about in Britain?
I don't know. I don't know who controls the policy of a bank. It must be a few, just a few people who've been brought up in the banking system and who stand by it and who stand again most by it, and they'll not let it go. It's only governments who can kill it. Just as that little government in South Australia, no, in New South Wales, just as that little government said, right, this is a savings bank, we'll make it into a bank of issue. And that made all the difference. It became a bank of issue. And all the other banks are the banks of issue. According to this man, theoretically, anybody can start a bank by doing certain things. But he said, in reality, it becomes a little difficult. Things are put in your way so that it becomes too difficult for you to start a bank. And then you have to incorporate into the other banks, because when your cheques come in, they've got to go back to the bank, which it's got to go from one of the present issuing banks back to that one, because it'll no end of banks will be involved if one new bank starts, because cheques will be given to all people who are in all sorts of banks, so they've got to be a part of the lot. That's why it'll become difficult to do it. They'll say, no, you can't. We won't accept your cheques. So this is the post office won't accept postal orders from ERA now. We've had a cheque for £2 from a man in ERA. They said, no, we don't accept these anymore. And the bank said, no, we don't accept them either. So I had to send it back to him. Ask him to get some payment to us in another way if he could, but he hasn't done yet. It's no use to us though.